Last night, the last question they asked, I heard you talk about the Buddha praising a monk who slouched over and seemed sleepy when meditating, while another monk with a very straight posture and a Buddha was worried about that monk. Which sutta was that, please? So I did promise I would tell you, and so here is the answer. But I must confess that I found the answer by emailing Ajahn Bhumali. I'm too honest. I got no books with me here. It's in the Nagata Sutta and Gutta Nikaya, the section on sixes, Sutta number 42. Sixes 42. And although just reading the English translation, it said that they use the word that he looked concentrated. And that is just, again, I really dislike the word for concentrating, samadhi, or in this case, samahitang, still is the correct word in the proper translations. So he appeared very still, the monk who was on the edge of the forest. And those was in the inside of the forest was quite sleepy. But because that monk was letting go, renouncing, that's why he was in the middle of the forest, and he was much more likely, and probably did, get into some deep meditations. So, that brings me on to an important point. With the sleepiness which people experience in meditation, and when you do experience sleepiness, what do most people do? They fight it. They think they can control sleepiness. They think that I can just sit here and I'm going to beat down that sleepiness. And you find that just makes you more tight, more tense. So in the time of the... When I was a young monk, it was just about the time of the Vietnam War. And I think my first year as a monk was when... Ho Chi Minh City, that Saigon and Vientiane and Phnom Penh, they fell within days of each other. But especially in Laos, because where we were in the northeast of Thailand was really close to Laos, and it was mostly Laotian culture. And even Ajahn Chah would actually talk Lao most of the time. Even though it belonged to the Thai nation, it was ethnically and culturally very Lao. And we had all these stories of some of the monasteries they had in Laos at that time. And one of the most famous monasteries was renowned for its meditation, because the teacher there was really tough, but very skilled. And what he would do is to take his new disciples on a walk through the jungles. After lunch, it's usually breakfast, usually finish your one meal a day about 9 o'clock in those monasteries, and then would walk through the mountains and jungles all day. Now those mountains and jungles were very steep, just like these hills over here. They're not just rolling hills like in England, they were steep hills. And so it's very exhausting, very tiring, and he would always manage to come to a place not far from the monastery, where there was these huge, tall rainforest trees, beautiful giant trees. And on top of some of the highest branches of those trees, the monks had built little platforms whose size was just like the cushion you're sitting on right now. No wider, no more length, and just flat. And there were bamboo ladders. And he would tell the monks who hadn't washed, who hadn't sort of had any cups of tea or anything like that, after walking all day, to climb up the ladder and sit on the meditation platform, high above. And once all the monks were sitting on their platforms, the teacher would take all the ladders away and leave them up there all night. There was no way down except straight down. To death. And so they said that so many monks got very deep meditation that way, that they overcame their sloth and torpor. At least, the ones who survived did. We never say about the ones who didn't survive. That's when I went into the jungles and I asked Ajahn Chah, he said, these jungles, there are elephants and tigers, and you saw elephant poo and tiger poo. He said, no, are they dangerous? He said, no. There's never been any story of a monk being eaten by a tiger. Of course not. The tigers would not confess. They can't speak human language. So the monk would just disappear. We didn't know where he went. You know, was it into Nibbana or into a tiger's tummy? Either way, we wouldn't know. So, it wasn't reassuring. But that was because they had stories like that. Stories like even in Ajahn Mun's time. He would take a monk who was always a little bit sleepy and take him to a cliff edge and make him sit on the very edge of the cliff and say, I'm not going to come back until morning. If you're still here, then well done. And we always hear the tales of the monks who were there in the morning, not the ones who fell off. And so because of those stories, when I was, again, young monk in Thailand, that we would go to a Wat Bawon in the center of Bangkok, you know, to stay to do our visas. And there, even some of the young monks there, Western monks, of course, they would actually go into the new building and sit right on the edge of the roof until the abbot of the temple said, look, monks, you know, you're not forest monks like in the good old days. Get back in your room. Because he didn't want to actually have to deal with the embassy, you know, when they found out the monks were dead at the bottom, banned us from doing that. But when we did stay at that monastery, I was suffered from sloth and torpor, as I mentioned to many of you. But then when we were staying at that monastery, it was one in Bangkok. It's a rich monastery. It was where the king in the morning. And so we asked, in that time of the day, it's not being used. Can we have the key? So we can open it and we can use it before alms round. And so, well, why not? So then for the couple of weeks I was in Bangkok doing my visa, we went in there at 3:30 in the morning, turned on the aircon, sat comfortably, no mosquitoes, no hot, no sloth and torpor. I was just really easy to meditate. And that's where I started to find out that sloth and torpor, your sleepiness, 99% of the time, it's just cause and effect. You know, I was a Westerner, you know, a Pulay. That's Bahasa. Kwai Lo, that's Ang Mo. So you're not used to such hot weather in the jungles, and the mosquitoes are always bothering you. And I really thought it was, you know, because of me, that, you know, I sort of was somehow lacking in some effort or some strength. But you really were trying your hardest. And I realized it was nothing to do with lack of effort, very much just the outside conditions. I know sometimes with due respect, oh no, huge respects to the Lord Buddha. If the Lord Buddha was born in London and he tried to meditate, sort of, you know, in Thailand, of course the heat, the food, everything was a little bit different. But once you got some good food, good rest, nice and cool, all sloth and torpor went. Before that, again, you know, you'd be really struggling. We did all these little tricks, like one of those little tricks, some of you have seen me do this before. You take a matchbox and take the cover off it, so you just had the tray full of matches, and you put it on your head. Because if you started to nod, it will fall down and make a sort of a noise. Not a loud noise, it's so bad you can hear the matchbox fall on the floor. And so that would give me some feedback. Many of you have already asked in the questions, how do I know that I'm not sleeping? Of course you don't know if you're sleeping. That's what sleep means. So, but that would tell me because I could hear the sound. And because of that, it only took me about a week to overcome my sloth and torpor. And I thought, wow, just having feedback, getting somebody to tell you whether you're sleepy or not, in this case my matchbox, that really worked. So I thought. Until one of the monks took me to sleep. It's so dispiriting. You really try, you think you're getting somewhere, you find, oh, you're back to square one. He said, I'll be watching you when you're meditating, Ajahn Brahm. I know why the matchbox is not falling off, because when you are meditating, you are nodding like this. My psychology is just the brain outsmarted me and I was still sleeping. But the experience in Bangkok, you know, obviously really good food in Bangkok, at least much better than you got in the northeast. A nice good night's sleep, cool place to meditate, no mosquitoes. It was conducive conditions. What they call in the Pali sapaya. It means conducive conditions, sapaya, which is where we get the Thai word sabai. Sabaya never meant me like nice and easy and lax and too comfortable. Sapaya meant it's supportive to the purpose of your endeavors. And to support it for meditation, that's what I really needed. So, you learn so much from that, to have enough sleep. Not too not much sleep, not too little sleep. If you try for too little sleep, you will be sleep deprived, obviously. Which means that your meditation will be sleepy. It's not under your power. It's the nature of your body. And the same if you have a sickness. If you have a sickness, it's not under your power to control it. It's the body doing its thing. Your body, your job is just to work with your body, not trying to control your body. But of course, that some people, and I made that mistake as well, decide to fight. So that sometimes in those early mornings, you get up and you are sleepy and say, no, I'm going to fight this. And I really focus on the breath or on the body. I was not going to move. I was not going to sort of nod at all. Really sort of screwing up my mind, putting out all my effort and refusing to be sleepy. That took so much effort. But sometimes it broke through the sleepiness. You weren't sleepy. And instead, I was restless. Couldn't stop thinking. So then I decided, okay, calm the thoughts down. Calm the thoughts down and then sleep again. And it was like two extremes of a pendulum. Either sloth and torpor, really sleepy and dull, or too restless and thinking too much. You couldn't find that sweet spot in the middle where you're awake but not thinking too much. And it took me a long time to figure out what was going on and why and how to overcome these things. And it was where I started to simulate in meditation. And it went far deeper than I ever anticipated, this idea of the mind having two parts to it. One of those parts is the... You okay there? Oh, what's that going on? Is it my hair is not... This is okay. Makeup. Can you make up? I remember having an interview once in Toronto. You know, it's supposed to be on the TV, you know. I never make up anything, but no, this interviewer. And then she stopped the interview for a moment. I didn't know why. And then sort of a little bit of her hair, instead of being here, it went over here. And she had to stop to get it moved to the right place. I couldn't imagine just what you have to do in TV. But anyway, the two parts of the human mind. The first part of the human mind is we call the doer, the active part of the mind. Always thinking, planning, remembering, always reacting to whatever the senses present to it. This is not good enough. I need to change my posture. I need to adjust my hair. I've got to adjust the sound. I've got to do something. It's the active doing part of the mind. And the second part of the mind is the knower, the awareness, mindfulness, if you like. It just knows, it receives the information, but doesn't react. It's like a scientist who just gathers the data from all the instruments of his experiment or her experiment, but doesn't try and consider what it means yet. Just absorb the data. That's the knower. The doer always thinks about it, adjusts it, interferes. It's always very active. And I think that many of you will appreciate, as human beings, we spend much more time doing things than knowing. Our mind is always active and busy and thinking and planning and working out and naming and figuring out what it means. So what that actually, the consequence of that is that the doer takes up so much energy. There's hardly any left for knowing. We're compulsive doers. Even on this retreat here, you don't have much to do. There's actually nothing to do. I give all the talks and the entertainment with all the silly jokes. All you've got to do is to sit here and meditate. But nevertheless, people always think and plan, and you're always still doing stuff. Which is one of the reasons why you get tired. And you'll notice that people who have lots of responsibility, executives, people in charge of stuff, they have to do so much, that is why they get grumpy and bad-tempered, because they are tired. They really, sometimes when you're in struggle to meet a deadline or many things come at you at the same time, that sucks up so much of your energy. You really get exhausted. So you're a bit grumpy, angry sometimes. But even anger doesn't solve the problem. It sucks up more energy. And so eventually people get frustrated. Why can't you see? Why can't you help? Why can't you do this? And they even get angry at their loved ones. And be careful, because after a little while you get so low energy, you get into depression. That's what depression is. It's just a low, 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 low energy. So much so that people tell me that if you have low energy depression, even a beautiful sunrise, been there, seen that, the colors aren't rich. They are washed out. The food, your most favorite food, you taste it, there's no taste to it. Now, where did that durian come from? No taste to it. Now, you see anything, I tell a joke to somebody, or do the sadhu, 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 sadhu. What's that got to do with Buddhism? They cannot engage, because everything is just there. And that's, if you've been depressed, that's what it's like. You can't get up in the morning because there's nothing to get up for. Everything is grey and dull and boring. All it really is your mind has got sucked out of energy, so there's hardly anything left for the knower. And if you try and fight the depression, that makes it worse. The little energy you have, you waste trying to fight. One of the reasons why that people have found that if you meditate, I don't mean concentrate, but relax. Just not do anything. Just know, it's depression. It's not very enjoyable, but it will pass by itself. Just relax and be there. Don't fight. And your energies come back. why the energies come back is important. Because your mind has a natural source of energy. And that natural source of energy, if it's not wasted by doing stuff, it's free to go into the knower. You're recharging sort of your knower. Just like in my room, somebody's very kindly lent me their mobile phone to make a Wi-Fi hotspot. So I can get my little tablet. I don't have an iPhone, I have that tablet. That's how I could contact Ajahn Bamali this morning and get the answer. But I've only got, you know, where my little desk is there, I've only got one PowerPoint. So I can't plug in the PowerPoint and the tablet at the same time. One gets the energy, the other one doesn't. So don't sort of get complicated. So we'll get a double adapter, we can do this. This is just a simile. And it's just like the knower and the doer. Only one can get energy. The other one has to wait. And so the doer is plugged in most of the time to your natural source of energy. That's why you get active. And your poor knower mindfulness has to wait and wait. If it gets just the dregs, the leftovers of the energy source. Which is why people are usually very dull. You think you're awake, but you're not. You come through this day, yeah, you know, you can know where your seat is. But there's no joie de vivre. There's no energy. There's no, it's really a struggle for me to get you all going, sadhu, 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 at 6 o'clock in the morning. But, you know, eventually you do it, you feel a bit better. But to be able to do that naturally without me sort of leading it, that would be quite something. And this is what happens. When you stop doing stuff, the energy goes into knower. Your mindfulness gets brighter and brighter and brighter. You are energizing your mindfulness. Which means your dullness, the sloth and torpor, just vanishes. Just like the mist in the early morning when the sun comes up. It just evaporates the mist, slowly but surely. And when the mist vanishes, you're clear, awake, but still. Not thinking. So that's when I get tired. My recent tiredness is because of jet lag. Just, I'm a really crazy monk. By the time I went to England, I was only left England about a week ago, but I only arrived there about 3 weeks ago. So I'm just getting over the jet lag from Australia to London. And as soon as you get over it, then you come here. And I have to readjust the jet lag again. Well, it doesn't matter. Just allow myself to be sleepy. But then when I am sleepy, I never fight it. If I'm sleepy, I'll just be sleepy. Aware as much as I can, but certainly not doing anything. And as I'm not doing anything, just being aware, then you notice, slowly, imperceptibly, the energies start to come back. And the body starts to strain. And the corners of the mouth start to turn up. You're awake. That's what happens. Because you're not forcing it, you're not controlling, you're not doing it. You're understanding causes and effects. The reason why sleepiness is there. And it's not your fault. Don't take it as a personal failure if you fall asleep during my talk. I will think it's my failure for giving boring talks. I don't know why that is the case. People come up to me and say, oh yeah, we listen to your talk every evening in bed. Is it that boring? You have to use that instead of sleeping tablets to go to sleep at night. Well, I don't care because they have a nice night's sleep. I don't care if it's because the talks are boring or because of the soft hypnotic voice. I don't care as long as they have a nice night's sleep. Out of compassion. How you use this stuff is up to you. So anyway, that when you realize that when you don't do things, you get energized, you start to realize a lot about how meditation works. You let go of doing. You let go of control. You let whatever's happening now be. You are still with it. You don't react to it. And people say, well, that must be boring. My goodness, it's not. When you're really still a lot, you don't fight the world. You're being with the world as much as you can. Obviously, sometimes you have to do stuff. If I need to go to the toilet, I don't say, oh, just let go. No need to go anywhere. It's all I'm well trying to go to the toilet. When you learn how to just let things be more and be still, your mindfulness gets empowered. It's energized. And this is one of the great things which I hope you will experience on this retreat if you haven't experienced it already. Every now and again you get a nice peaceful meditation. Peaceful, but not sleepy, but really alert and awake. And you open your eyes afterwards, and just even the room appears brighter. The body, you can feel much more of it. You look upon those tiles. Now, what colour is those tiles? Grey. I once did this and I got told off because I said there's many shades of grey. And apparently that's a naughty book which became popular. So it's actually, Bob, what have you been up to? It's just colours, I don't know these things, it's just grey. Different shades of grey. You can see the dark grey and the lighter grey and the in-between grey. But first of all, it's boring, just ordinary, one colour. But you look with more depth, with an awakened mind, or at least a mind which is stronger, and it's amazing. And that's one of, so many times this has happened to me, but, you know, talking about the colour of the floor, over in what, Nana Chats, when I was one of the first six monks there, the first hall they built was concrete, just concrete, nothing on top of the concrete, and except the monks, when we were doing walking or sitting. But there's no cover on it, and so during the rains retreat, because it was pouring with rain outside, that's where we do the walking meditation inside. I went to a walking meditation there on the concrete, poured by the villagers. So number one, it was not smooth, it was bumpy all over the place. And just so many different sort of shades of the colour on there. And I was walking there, putting my attention about body length in front of me, about, you know, 1 point, I don't know, metres, whatever it was. And just being very mindful, very quiet, just noticing my legs moving. It got very, very peaceful. And then I had to stop, because the piece of concrete, it's just like it opened up to me. And it wasn't just the different types of colour grey, it was just the texture of the concrete. It was like a mountain range, just little hills and valleys, and the whole thing became so beautiful. And it was most amazing, beautiful, gorgeous piece of artistic concrete that I'd ever seen before. And I just looked at it and looked at it and looked at it. It was amazing. So many times these things happened to me. In my first meditation retreat in Cambridge, as a student, we were allowed to go for a walk exercise. It was in boarding houses, small rooms, almost all the day. About 1 hour in the morning, we could go for a walk before breakfast. And I knew that place because I was studying there, so I went to the botanical gardens. And in the botanical gardens, I thought I'd have a walk. I just didn't get past the entrance, because out of the entrance was a clump of bamboo. Even up in Asia, I've been to Asia before then, I'd never seen such a beautiful clump of bamboo at the entrance to the Cambridge Botanical Gardens. It was actually stunning. And just, that's why that in Chinese watercolours, paintings, they always have bamboo. Not other, well, they do have other trees and other flora, but bamboo is there because it's just so slender and sensuous, just the way it just goes really tall and tapers and just bends under its own weight. And just even the leaves are just, they're not these big fat leaves like Western leaves, they're very slender and small and tapering. And even the colors, they're very subtle. So when I saw that, I thought, wow, this is amazing. It was so beautiful. It just captured my attention. And I just gazed at it. It must have been for at least 15 or 20 minutes before I started to get a little bit of caution that if someone, you know, an ordinary person, had seen me not moving for 15 minutes, they would have called the ambulance and taken me away. Because you're not supposed to do that in England. So I found a bench. There was a bench close by. I sat on the bench, and sitting on the bench and not moving and staring, that's okay. So for 15 minutes I just stared at that beautiful piece of bamboo, and I never finished with it. So I went back there the next day, and the next day, and the next day, for 8 days. One day I decided I did need some exercise, so I went by the river. But for 8 days I was entranced by this clump of bamboo. So gorgeous, so beautiful, and I could just spend all day just gazing at it. But then the retreat ended, and I went back to studies, and one afternoon had, I think, a tutorial or supervision was cancelled. So I got on my bicycle and I said, I'm going to go and check out my really beautiful piece of bamboo. My bicycle there, and I got to the entrance. Where's my beautiful bamboo gone? Instead there was this dry, dusty, no colour at all, desiccated, weedy, just something which just shouldn't be there. Bamboo doesn't grow well in English climate. It's the same bamboo, but all its beauty had gone. I just couldn't see it anymore. My mind had closed. Or rather, I was too tired, exhausted. Just the ordinary exhaustion which everybody feels, and they don't notice it, of doing so much. Now I couldn't see it anymore. I would need to really become very peaceful, very still, to get the energies of mindfulness growing. Then I might be able to see it. These were personal experiences which other people have as well. At this point I usually quote one of my favorite poets, William Blake, 17th century. And he was the one who said, to see a world in a grain of sand, see a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. When he used the word hour for eternity, he didn't mean the 1 hour meditations which we do, which may sound or feel like an eternity for you. If you don't know how to meditate. It was just, it rhymed with flower. So, you know, he really meant in a moment or in timeless. To see a world in a grain of sand. You need to be aware and have powerful mindfulness. Because that's what happens just in a piece of concrete or in just a tiny little... Where's it gone? Where's that beautiful thing gone? It's just a piece of lint. And you look at it and you see its shape and its colour. Your mind really gets into it and explores it when you're very peaceful. It's a tiny grain of sand. There's a whole world in there. And when you see a little flower, the wild flowers are usually the tiny ones. Subtle, many people miss. But if you just can focus in there, they just reveal their secrets for you. Beautiful in tiny things. That's where you need strong, powerful mindfulness. Because you haven't been doing very much. The energies come. And everything just really takes off and becomes beautiful. So what's that got to do with meditation on the breath, say? When you start watching your breathing, if you have enough stillness and mindfulness first, it means that your mindfulness is strong. You can see a heaven in a wild flower. You don't force it, it just comes up at you. And the same you're breathing. This is gorgeous. So many different parts, just the one in-breath. And it looks very delightful and beautiful. This is where you develop what I used to call the beautiful breath, but I prefer delightful breath these days. Well, in the Anapanasati Sutta, breathing in, experiencing joy and pleasure. Breathing out, experience joy and pleasure. This is not manufactured by you. It is just nature. And you get very still and peaceful. Even your breath looks gorgeous. And that's also why in the Anapanasati Sutta from the Buddha, it said this is a citta sankhara. This is how the mind looks at the breath when it's really still. The mind is still, it really just powers up, it energizes. And you're watching the breath and you can't, wow, I can do this all day. Breathing in, wow. Breathing out, wow. Now you don't make those noises. But that is just to give you some idea what goes on. Breathing in, oh, no. And you know, for a long time, no one taught me this. It was there in the suttas. Ajahn Chah was teaching, but I never got it at first. You know, but then when it happens, why is this breath so beautiful, delightful? Why is he doing walking meditation? And it's great. It's fun. Why just walking backwards and forwards? You must be crazy to think that stuff, just pacing back and forth. That's sometimes what people do, what I'm being told by psychiatrists, when people are incarcerated for such a long time. They just go back and forth, back and forth. No joy at all, just something to do. But when you get into deep meditation, that's what happens, naturally. So I remember just taking this down to the walking meditation in... Where I ordained as a monk was in Bangkok. You know, I never knew Ajahn Chah at first. This is an interesting anecdote. Now, you know, I was a Buddhist when I was 16. Some people say 17, I was 16. I know, because I was there at the time. And that never knew any Buddhists until I went to Cambridge. And there was a Buddhist society there. Wow, Buddhist societies. And that's why I really love supporting things like the BGF, Lay Buddhist Society. If there wasn't a Lay Buddhist Society at my university, then I wouldn't have become a Buddhist monk. I'd have just probably got into other stuff. So just, you know, clubs support one another, and look after one another, just do events together. It really encourages us. So that's one of the reasons why Buddhist societies, you know, I'm going to try and pay off my debts. You help me, I can help you. So, when are we... Now, where was I going with this? Were you paying attention? I wasn't. So, yeah, get out of the delightful breath and doing the walking meditation. So, going back, I used to go to the Thai temple, and I told them I wanted to become a monk. I quit my job as a school teacher. I was just waiting and waiting and waiting for a place to go to. And some of these people would come through. There was one gentleman, and he said, oh, he was a monk in Thailand recently, and he's just disrobed. So I asked him, oh, do you know any nice places to go to, really good places where I can meditate? And no, he had just been at Ajahn Chah's monastery. And he disrobed from there. And he never told me about it. And now afterwards, when he came to visit, I was a monk for about a year, he came to visit, why didn't you tell me about Ajahn Chah? I've heard it myself. And this monk said, you were too happy. I didn't think you were serious. As if you have to go, you have to be really suffering before you become a monk. Or a nun. No. I was happy. Honestly, I didn't become a monk to get rid of suffering. I actually became a monk to pursue freedom. Different. And so I was very happy because I was meditating at the time. But still, you know, I wanted to take it further. So he never recognized that. So anyway, that's why I ended up in the middle of Bangkok meditating. But every morning, you know, I'd go for 1 hour, we'd do a little bit of chanting with the other monks, and a 1 hour walking meditation in the main hall in Wat Saket. And in that main hall, I don't know why they have this, they have grandfather clock. Every quarter of an hour, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, dong. It was fashionable, but it's not really that good for meditation. No, sitting meditation, walking meditation was good. Because then you couldn't sort of silence it. You actually, that's how you manage to time yourself. So I was, you know, walking there, and it took me, it's maybe not as big as this hall, for lengthwise. It took me half an hour to get from one end to the other, turn around, and half an hour to go back. Wasn't forcing it, but just got very mindful, and all the stuff was happening in your feet. Just in a one step, it was amazing. And I really got into it, and it was fascinating, but so enjoyable. Just watching my feet move. Going forward, totally natural, unforced. And that's why, usually, just without trying to go slow or fast, it took about half an hour by the rings of the grandfather clock to go to the end and come back again. So I knew 1 hour, then I could go off to the next appointment. But this morning, I'm maybe about three quarters, maybe halfway through the 1 hour walking meditation. And I was focusing down, just watching the feet move, and amazing just how many sensations there. And it was so delightful. I was so peaceful. I was just in my own little world with my feet. And it was a lovely world. And then I heard a sound, like you do when you're in deep meditation. You hear a sound that's like 100 miles away. You're so focused. It's way maybe just over the other side of KL somewhere. And it was Brahma Wang So, Brahma Wang So. It was fascinating, just one sound, just all the different tones which were in Brahma Wang So. And it was incredibly beautiful, just the way the pitch of the note and how the sound comes out with a little puckering of the lips, and then and I was fascinated just by the word Brahma Wang So, let alone trying to figure out where it came from. And then it got a tiny bit louder. Brahma Wang So. And then I realized that right next to me there was a monk shouting in my ear. It wasn't a long way away. I forgot that I had to go early, you know, for an appointment for a house dana. And my preceptor, you know, he's a Somdek Gyo, but he came, he told his monk, go and get, you know, Brahma Wang So, we've got to go to a dana, we're late. And he was shouting in my ear. But for me, it was like the way, way, way away. So I realized, and I remembered, oh yeah, in the dana. So then I had to, you know, to speak to someone, you've got to, you know, look at them. So I was moving my head. Just to move your head. It's amazing the amount of sensations and muscles have to move for you to turn around. And I was fascinated. I could not accelerate. I was in just, not my first gear, but maybe in a 0.000001 gear. And I just, really hard to actually to get, you know, wound up again. And it took about 2 minutes or 3 minutes before I could turn around and make eye contact. And then, it's amazing just to move your lips and actually to say, what? And to speak. Because you're just having so much joy and you just, it was out of control, you couldn't do anything. So because the monks, there were monks and they knew meditation, so they understood. I wasn't crazy, I just was enjoying my beautiful walking meditation. Had the Piti Sukha coming up. Very joyful. And they said, then you start to really realize what happens when you get very still. And you start to get energy up in your mind. You're not going crazy, you're having a wonderful time. And it's only just starting. Oh, there's more to come, and it's really juicy stuff. Wonderful stuff. Great stuff. Totally healthy. Positive for your well-being. And once you understand this, you understand just how the meditation works. So, basically, I don't care. It's not really important what you're watching. As long as you are lessening your busyness. Doing less. And being more, being here, not worrying about where you're going to go to, and not being concerned where you came from. You imagine yourself like the wind flowing past your face. Who knows where the wind came from, or what baggage it carries. All you'll ever know is the wind as it touches your skin for a moment. And then where the wind goes, which direction, which destination, only the wind knows that. You just feel it in this moment. That is how to meditate. No past, no future, just this moment. The sound of this monk going into your ears. You don't know what sound's going to happen next. What happened before is gone. Just this experience of now, that's all you need to know. And after a while, all of the theories, all of the words, you don't need them anymore because you're there, peaceful. And you stay with whatever's there. You don't fight it. You don't try and change it, it'll change by itself. You just know without doing anything. You don't even try to remember it. That's one of the other terrible things. We always try to capture the past. Important moments of our life. Important teachings. Important experiences. We always want to freeze so we can go back there whenever we want. When I finished university, I think it was a year afterwards, when I finished teacher training, I decided to do one last trip overseas, because going overseas was very, very tiring. And I was a Buddhist, I thought this is my chance to go on pilgrimage in the summer of 1973. I was a Buddhist and I thought, I've going to be working as a school teacher, soon find a nice girl, fall in love, have babies, and that's the end of any travelling for you. So I thought, I'll get it done now. So I went over to India to go on pilgrimage. But on the way, I always wanted to see the Himalaya Mountains. So people have shown me pictures of them. Gorgeous spread of snow-capped peaks, stretching across the horizon as far as you could see. And that was one of my to-do lists. But of course, I never did any research. I just went there and I found out that summertime was monsoon season and the whole mass of mountains was covered with clouds. Many times I went up there to try and see them, never did. It was monsoon and the clouds covered the whole range of mountains, so they were obliterated from view. So I gave up even trying to actually to see those Himalayas. Then one day in Kathmandu, I heard from the other travelers there was a post bus. The postage every Thursday or Wednesday would go up to the Tibetan border, to the far north of Nepal, couldn't cross into China. But would go there and then come back again. And it was illegal. You're not even supposed to go on the post bus. But it was 73 and the postman was very poor. If you gave him enough enough cash, he let you go in the back. And so that's what we did, up early in the morning, the post van. And travelling, way up into the Himalayas, into the border. And then when he stopped for tea, just in the morning time, There was another couple of an American man and his wife also in this trip. And we decided, you know, to climb up this tiny hill. Well, not a tiny hill, it took about half an hour to get to the top, maybe 20 minutes. We got to the top. A miracle. The clouds parted. And there was the Himalaya Mountains, a whole range. It was breathtaking. Wow. So what did I do? I ran down to the post van, because my camera was still in there. And I ran back up again. As far, I could run quite fast those days, you know. I had about 22. I ran back up again. And as soon as I... This was done by Mara. I'm sure Mara was for... Because as soon as I just saw them, they closed up. And the American man and his wife said, "Where were you? It was beautiful. It was gorgeous." And stupid Ajahn Brahm. I was Peter then. Stupid young man. If I had not tried to capture that, I would have been able to enjoy it. But because I tried to capture it, I lost it. And that taught me a good lesson. It was worth it. I saw the Himalayan mountains later on in my life. But what I really needed then was to be able to experience life without trying to hold it, to pickle it, to freeze it for later on. Life is what happens now. And then it goes. You can't hold on to things. If you do, it's a lot of baggage, a lot of suffering, and you miss life as you're trying to capture the old stuff. So that's why when you learn how to be mindful, you don't need to capture anything. Every moment is beautiful, lovely. Why do you want to miss the present moment? Because you're keeping something which is rotten in the past. Why is it that people carry coffins of dead moments on top of their head and in their brain? They're coffins of dead moments, dead experiences. They're gone, they're past, and they're rotting. Clear them out so you can be open for what's happening right now. And so, what you actually see right now doesn't become boring, because you're free, you're energized, you're not burdened. There's beautiful energy, lightness to you. Your mindfulness is strong, whatever you look at. Just a boring old tile becomes amazing. Just a dry clump of bamboo, which should not be put in such a climate, becomes absolutely wonderful. And you see just maybe your old grandma. She's gorgeous. And she's old. She's wrinkled. Oh, yeah. But you see something much more. And just whatever food you have, and you do simple things, just like walking. Simpler the better. And it becomes so amazingly wonderful. And you start to watch your breathing. No effort needed at all. No restlessness. No tiredness. You can't take your mind's eye off your breathing. It's amazing. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. And the more you watch it, the more beautiful it becomes. The breath going in. The breath going out. If this is what meditation's about, I'm in. And that is what meditation is meant to do. Again, if anybody doubts, Dhamma Chaitya Sutta is the time, I think I may have mentioned this already, certainly in every other retreat or every other talk about meditation. And the reason I keep mentioning this is because sometimes people say, "This can't be right. You're happy?" Religion isn't about being happy. It's being to do good so you can be happy when you die. And of course, and that's why many people turn off religion. So it's not just torturing yourself now so you can be happy after you die. It's realizing the happiness is right here. The the joy, the power. And anyway, in the Dhammacetia Sutta, oh, that's right, somebody once said, the Puritan religion. Now that's an extreme form of Protestantism. People like Calvin. And they once said that was actually the Christianity which went to the United States. And it explains a lot about, you know, the United States, its culture, and why people do what they do. And in those early sort of forefathers of the United States, the Puritans, somebody summed up their philosophy that it was based on fear. The fear that someone, somewhere, is happy. Oh, and that was a very sort of piercing comment, that if you're happy, it means you're not practicing. And there's a similarity with some sort of types of Buddhism. You're not allowed to be happy. Wipe that smile off your face, you're indulging. No pain, no gain. Strive for enlightenment. And you try that and you don't get anywhere. But again, Dhammacetia Sutta, King Persephone going to see the Buddha and noticing and recorded all the happy monks in the Jetavana monastery. There's no nuns, the nuns were in a different monastery. If they went to the nuns monastery, that would be beautiful, happy, smarty nuns. So happy. And the Buddha said, yes, that is what you can expect when the monks are practicing properly and getting insights. Happiness. A smile. And I've said this before, but sometimes I give away some of my tricks as a teacher, but I don't mind because I've told too many people already. That if somebody comes to me in an interview and they said they just had this amazing meditation, they just got a jhana or something, I look at them. I don't believe them. I just look at their face first of all. And if their mouth is horizontal, I say, no way. Don't care what you describe. I'm looking for the afterglow. And if their face got this beautiful smile on their face, I jump out. Oh, amazing meditation. It was so beautiful. Okay, confirmed. You can't fake that. Unless you're some amazing actor who should be sort of in Hollywood somewhere. But you can fake the words. You can fake the descriptions. But just the emotional power of these days, the happiness, the joy, that you can't. So anyway, this is what happens. Why? You're really still. More and more still. More and more power, energy, natural energy going in to your awareness, your knowing. It's not up to you. It's not what you develop. It's what you allow to happen. You get out of the way and it just comes. That is how the meditation really takes off. And when that happens, people love coming to meditation retreats. That's why some of you know, you try and get in on one of my meditation retreats in Perth, you've got to be right next to the internet. I think I don't know what the time is, because I don't have to book, I always get in. I teach the thing. Right on the internet, right at the time. And even then, sometimes, you're not quick enough, you're on the waiting list. Fills in within minutes. Why? I mean, why do people actually just trying to hurt themselves and take away their holiday time? There must be something there where it's really powerful and very popular, very attractive. find some real beautiful happiness, some joy, and joy which has no bad side effects. Many of the pleasures in this world, you know, are either they just, you know, they're illegal, or they get into trouble, or they start families, or all sorts of just sticky. But the pleasures of meditation are just so liberating and free. And they also have these wonderful side effects. Excellent health. Really get some beautiful energy coming up. And just insights, freedoms. So free happiness. And understanding just why it is we work so hard, we do so much. We don't need to, especially in meditation. So, to sum up, if you're tired, sleepy, it's natural. Go to your room and take a break. Rest. If you're going to rest, do it properly. Don't just go sleeping down here. That's not efficient use of your body. Go to your bed and lie down and have a sleep. How many other places can you do that? People say, you're lazy, you should be doing something. Come on. You never get enlightened that way. So you do get enlightened that way. Because you're being peaceful. You're being kind to your body. Getting rid of your sleep deficit. And then, when you're very peaceful, you sit down, you don't have sloth and torpor. You've got energy. When you've got energy, mindfulness, thinking, you don't need to think anymore. Thinking is just escape. You escape to... How many of your thoughts are really useful? Maybe 1%, and that's being kind. That is one of the reasons why powerful monks or nuns would never read your minds. Channels or 600 channels on the TV, let alone on the Netflix, whatever that means, but anyway, on your computer. And you look on that and no, nothing on the TV. And then you go, let's get something to eat. And you open the fridge door and things start falling out and there's nothing in there. The point is that nothing is satisfying to you. So that's why you go into your data bank of future fantasies. Imagine, I'm going to become enlightened. But before I become enlightened, I use my psychic powers to find out what's the lottery number coming up next week. So, or even better, go up the hill there and I can see the roulette wheel. And I use my powers to control that little ball so it goes in the number where I put all the money on. And you have all these fantasies and dreams. Totally useless. But just pure escapism. And as somebody once told me, said this person said, the point of a fantasy is in your fantasy because you control it. You're always the winner. You're always the hero. You never lose in your fantasy. Only in the real world you always lose. It's not the same. But anyway, why do you do that? Because you haven't got enough happiness now. If this moment is really happy, very joyful, you don't need fantasies and thoughts and memories of the past or anything. Because you are satisfied. It's just like when you have your lunch. Like, you know, you're really kind to me, trying to find out the food which I'd like. And you put so much of that food on the table for me. Even though it's delicious food, when I get full, you can't eat anymore. So when you have enough happiness inside of you, fantasies, dreams, stuff, you know, any sensory pleasure, you don't need it. You're full, satisfied. This beautiful, pure inner pleasure of peace and strong mindfulness. And then, say with that strong mindfulness, it's empowered. So it's like you turn the lights on, and the lights on, and the lights on, and the lights on. Everything's so bright and clear. So you can actually see it. thoughts. When people actually sometimes tell me, say, oh, these thoughts, they just come from nowhere. And they come into my mind. No, that's not how things are. Thoughts don't invade your mind. You go looking for them. You're not aware enough to see that, but you're sitting there pretty bored, nothing's really working. There's a thought over there, and you grab it and bring it in. Oh, no, I didn't bring it in, it just came by itself. And you start all those thoughts. When you're really peaceful, mindful, and happy, just the thoughts, they can't come in. You don't need them, because you're satisfied. So that's one of the reasons people say, well, Ajahn Brahm, you haven't mentioned the breath yet, or I'm counting the breath, or I'm doing metta meditation, or kusumas, or this, that, and that. It's more important that you relax and let go, and stop doing so much. That is the first instructions here. Simple, but nevertheless, I just draw it out, expand it this way and that way, and spend a whole 1 hour and 8 minutes telling you how not to do anything. But I need to do that just to counter just that whole tendency of your life always to be active and do something. So, I'm going to finish off soon. So afterwards, just relax and don't do anything. But actually, how do you do that? You don't do it. That's the point. You get out of the way and let it happen. You disappear. You get lost. You vanish. You're gone, baby. You're gone. Sadhu. 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 Okay. Enough instructions for the day.